Welcome, guys, to episode 210 of Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and it is my honor to introduce this week a man who I met running a Spartan race. His name is Monty Montgomery. He is a World War II veteran. He was 92 years old running the race that I was running as well with the Operation Enduring Warrior crew, and is also a retired Miami-Dade firefighter working in our profession for over three decades. So as you can imagine, this conversation was fantastic. From his early years, the end of World War II, the observation of racism and segregation, entry into the fire service, the way that's changed, and then what he and his wife did when they retired, some incredible stories out of that as well. So as I always say before we start, please go to your podcast app, subscribe, but also leave a rating and feedback. I love seeing what you've written, but also the more ratings we get, the more exposure we have to everyone that's looking. And then take your social media and help share this project. These incredible men and women that we have every single week need to be heard by so many people, and you guys are the key to helping spread this project. So with that being said, I introduce to you Monty Montgomery. Enjoy. All right, well, I want to start at the very beginning. I'll firstly start by saying thank you for inviting me to your beautiful home. It was nice meeting you guys at the race, and I really appreciate that we were able to do this.
Thank you. It was our pleasure.
So, very first question, where were you actually born?
In Baltimore, Maryland.
Baltimore.
I was delivered at home by the same doctor that delivered my mother when she was a baby.
Really?
Yep.
So, back then, was that actual community a small community then?
Well, it was part of Baltimore city itself, but it was an individual community. It was called Hamden, and it was just a little different than the rest of Baltimore. And I grew up there, and I remember the Maryland Casualty Company had big land there, and as I was growing up, they had a tree there called the Tarzan Tree. I spent more time as a kid climbing trees and doing things, and you know how it is with a bunch of boys. I'm going to do this. You guys, you can't do that. Some of the things that my mother ever knew that I did, I got up on top of the walkway across the bridge on 40th Street, which is about 50 feet above the railroad track, and walked along the top of it. Just to show other kids, showing off. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when I was in junior high, the guys had the big iron horse, you know, leather iron horse, whatever, I forget what you call it, that you do gymnastics on, and they were jumping to the chinning bar. And because I was so used to climbing the trees and jumping and stuff, I said, let me show you how to do this. So I pushed it back some, which I could have easily made, but because I was showing off, just as I jumped, the guy pushed the thing. And all I did, I just caught the very edge of it, swung up in the air, and came down on the wooden floor with my head. I got a 7-inch fracture down there. I broke an eardrum. I had a blood clot for years. My lips would... no feeling, and I drink something, and I have to be careful that it didn't run back out. But gradually, the nerves grow back and so forth, and I'm almost normal now.
It took 9 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing, though, with that story, when you later on in life became a firefighter, and you see that, just one fraction of a second's bad decision, whether it's walking out in front of a car or, it can be life-changing.
We never know when we're going to go. I mean, you walk out the door and get struck by lightning. Our friends on another boat, they were just struck by lightning about a year ago?
Really?
And they've got everything back together. Everything's fixed. Would you believe it or not, they got struck by lightning again? It's not supposed to strike in the same place twice, but it did for them. If... if it wasn't for bad luck, they wouldn't have any luck at all.
Well, they have their health and they have a boat, so there's the good luck.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Then just talking about where you grew up as well, this is an interesting observation for someone, you know, with several generations under their belt now. What I have discovered myself, I grew up on a farm. When I got older, I'm like, okay, I'm a fireman. I work in inner cities most of my career. I want to get away from that. Ultimately, I want to have a piece of land and get away from people. And then some very intelligent people kind of made me aware of the whole tribal element of humans. The old towns and villages in New Zealand and England, we had those. And then now, you know, you have the kind of suburban America where you have all these sprawling neighborhoods and people don't spend a lot of time talking to each other. Did you have that real community in the town that you grew up in? And have you observed that kind of essence changing in that you've seen?
Oh, certainly. I remember if you were in trouble back then and you did something wrong, your neighbors let your parents know right away and you were in trouble. And the same way with a teacher. I mean, if I did something wrong in school, my teacher let my parents know and I didn't want to go home. I knew something was going to happen to me when I got home. But it was a completely different world back then. It was so different. And you're right, you know, we talked to neighbors. In fact, people used to, they had porches in front of these houses where I lived, and people would sit out there and they'd have swings or armchairs. And in the evening, they'd sit out there and this neighbor would talk to that neighbor. And you just knew everybody in the neighborhood, you know.
Yeah, that seems like it's something that if we were able to find that again, where I ended up not finding a mini farm and doing the complete opposite and moving into a big community in Ocala where there's a lake and swimming pool and tennis courts and a football pitch, you know, soccer pitch, and tracks. And kids can leave the house, go out on their bikes, go play all day. When the streetlights come on, they come home, just like we talk about. And I see how that has helped. And it's a very diverse community. And all these kids play together. All these, you know, these parents talk to each other when they're walking their dogs. Is that something that you think if we found again, it would be a benefit to our country?
I think it would. We didn't have any organized games, you know, like they have today, where the kids all have their uniforms and everything's organized and they have coaches. We used to just get together and we had a game. It was similar to football. It was kill the guy with the ball. And whoever got the football, the whole game would try to, you know, chase him down and tackle him. And he would lose the ball and somebody else would get it and start running and we'd go after him and so forth. But it was just spontaneous. You know, we didn't organize it or anything. And as far as like bikes, I used to ride my bike to school because I moved from the neighborhood where I grew up, and I guess we were about 10 miles away, and I used to get up in the morning and ride my bike to school. And my grandmother still lived there, and I used to leave the bike at her house and then walk the other half mile down to school. And half the time I was late, especially after I went past this orchard, I'd always stop and grab a couple of apples or something. They were good days. They were. And, of course, in the 40s, and especially after we got into the war, soldiers, you know, if they were in uniform and they got on a streetcar or a taxi cab, they wouldn't take money. Of course, I wasn't supposed to be old enough to be in a bar, but if you went in a bar and a serviceman came in and wanted a drink, they wouldn't charge. I mean, everything was for the serviceman. And it was so bad or so terrible, I thought, when the guys from Vietnam came back. And no matter how you think about the politics of the war, those guys were over there and they suffered and they fought and they went through hell and they should have got a reception like we had with that honor flight. But they didn't. And my brother, Carol, He was over in Vietnam three times. And he had some, I don't remember exactly what happened, but he had some experiences with people being nasty to him and so forth.
Yeah, but it's interesting observation. The same guy actually taught me about the whole community thing. He was also underlying exactly what you said. So when World War II finished, and I'd love to, you know, talk about that in a little bit, there were the ticker tape parades. You know, everyone was welcomed back as a hero. With the Vietnam, who were drafted as well, people got to remember that. Most of those men were forced to go over there. It was the reverse. So with the mental health side, when you look historically, I believe that comparatively there was so many more problems post-Vietnam because there was no demob. There was no way of them processing what they'd been through, because not only were they obviously just like there, they had a true enemy. They came back here and they were called baby killers and spat on, and you know, I mean, it's a horrible way to treat people that we forced to another country to go supposedly fight our war.
Yeah. And you know, they went in probably thinking the same way that we did in World War II, that, well, we'll go over there, you know, we're fighting for our country, but which they really weren't. But they had that mindset in their head, you know, and then to come back and be treated like dirt, it was terrible, terrible.
Yeah, and the resistance to the war, I mean, obviously, we look at some of our conflicts and realize that there was politics behind some of them, and these men and women should never have been sent in harm's way in the first place. But the common thread that I find from a lot of the members of military that I've interviewed is once they get over there and they see some of the awful things that people are doing in those countries, then that for them is justifying it. You know, if they're in Iraq and they're seeing these stonings and beheadings and awful things, you know, this, I don't want to go too much into it, but this lack of humanity, then they absolutely can justify stopping that. And I think that's what people don't understand. We sit here, I mean, right now we're in South Florida, you know, if you'd never been in the service at all, your life would be amazing. And then you get all judgy when people come back. Whereas we've asked people to go and see these horrendous things and, you know, put them in a situation where they have no choice but to kill. I mean, they, if you're watching kids being, you know, brutalized, of course you'd pull the trigger away, wouldn't you?
Yeah, it's sometimes you're just put in a situation that you have no control of, and whether it looks good or bad to other people, it's something that you have no control over and you can't help. And it's not right that you be judged that way.
Absolutely.
I think.
Well, going back to your school period. So when you were younger, before, you know, World War II kicked off, especially the American involvement, what were your career aspirations when you were before the service?
Well, when I was growing up, I wanted to be a helmet diver. That I had seen some movies and so forth, and it looked like it was a lot of fun. And I was told that if you don't have perfect teeth, you can't be a diver. I don't know what that had to do with it. Just like with you, you know, you
the
wanted to be a firefighter.
Exactly.
And they said you couldn't be. Well, in the end, I wound up being a diver, actually even diving for a living. In fact, I opened the first dive store up in Norfolk. I moved from Baltimore to Norfolk after I got out of the Army, and started the first dive club up there. And then after I left Norfolk and came down here, I got really into diving. I met her and taught her a little bit about diving. She couldn't even swim when I met her, and she claims she still can't swim without a mask and snorkel, but I don't know. She does pretty good. But I wound up getting a job for a while taking dive trips out, and I had didn't make any money at it, but it was, in my mind, it was an exotic kind of a life thing, and this is fun. The only thing is that we didn't have two pennies to put together, because we only charged $15. We would take people out, and half the time I'd have to save them because they would panic when they came to the surface. And if they had their own equipment, we only charged them $10. And when I look back and see what these dive boats are charging people today to take 30 people out on a dive trip, and they're all paying, I don't know, it's not only $15, I guarantee you. But like you were talking about a little while ago, things change so much, you know. And the equipment in diving and so forth has changed so much, too. I mean, they wear these inflatables so that they get in any trouble or panic, they can inflate it and bring them up. We used to buy these almost like what you get on an airplane to put over your head and put a cartridge in it. And if I had somebody that was starting to panic and we were not close to the boat, I just squeeze the little trigger thing on it and inflate it and calm them down. They'd be perfectly all right as long as they didn't think they were drowning, you know, which is normal. I mean, of course. But we didn't have any money. We were living off of fish and lobster. And Friday, our landlady, who was Catholic, didn't eat steak or any meat on Friday. So she would give us, we look forward to Friday because we could have something besides fish and lobster. And we did eat a lot of liver because that was the cheapest meat that we could buy. And it was really tough until I finally got on the fire department and I was making $75 a week on the fire department. And we thought we were in hog heaven. And then, of course, things got better and better. And in between all that, I was also taking pictures because I was a photographer. And I took baby pictures, which doesn't sound like much, but it was one of the toughest jobs I ever had.
I'm sure.
Oh, you try to keep up with two-year-olds and keep their mother out of the picture. And, oh, man, and carry two or three strobe lights, a great big tripod, and a 5x7 camera, because in those days, everything was black and white, and you had these big cameras. And I stayed in great shape just carrying that stuff around all day. But after I came down here to Florida and was taking the dive trips out, the picture taking sort of died off because there weren't that many kids. I mean, at that time, it was mostly elderly people that retired and came to Florida. Nowadays, I mean, there's kids everywhere. But back then, and I'd go knocking on doors just trying to get business. And they used to have all the jealousy windows, you know, that you open. And you'd be out there with a tie and coat and everything trying to look decent. And telling people, you know, that you're taking pictures in the neighborhood, and they'd open that little jealousy window and say, "We're not interested." Or, "We got taken last time." And after about an hour or so of this, you feel like the next person that comes to the door acts nasty to me. I had a lady one day, I knocked on the door. And I was going to ask her, you know, if there was any small children or babies there. And she had this little dog that come right out and bit my ankle. Oh, I got so mad and I start chasing him down the street. She said, "My little dog, my little dog." I said, "Lady, if I catch him, I'm going to put him in a mouse trap." She didn't think it was very funny at the time.
So you didn't get to take a picture on that one.
Another time I went to a trailer park. Once in a while we'd have trailer parks that we would go to and take pictures there. And it was really, and this was back in the 60s, and a lot of them didn't have air conditioning. And you'd stand up in the trailer, and it was 100 degrees when I'm standing up. Down there a little bit lower, with maybe 80 or livable. But I knock on this one door, and this lady comes out, and her hair's up in curls, and she's got a house coat on. And she, "What do you want?" I said, "Are you Mrs. Jones?"
She says, no, I'm not.
I said, oh, thank God. Just a couple of little experiences, along the way. So anyway, I also had a job working in this dive store on Biscayne Boulevard in the evenings. I was taking pictures at the hotel at night, and I was taking dive trips out during the day, and I worked at this dive shop in between. And one day this girl comes in and wanted to use the telephone, and it turns out she was driving cars all over the country. And that way she was seeing the country without, having to pay a tourist guide or anything of that sort. And I thought it was pretty smart. And I invited her out for dinner, and I've never been able to get rid of her.
Beautiful. Well, you talked about a few things I want to go back to. Firstly, when you were in Norfolk, did you ever work with any of the Navy divers, the frogmen, or any of those guys that were?
No.
No? Okay, because I know that ultimately became a hub for the East Coast SEAL teams. That's interesting.
One more thing. There was a swimmer, an Olympic swimmer. It was in the newspaper that he was going to swim across Hampton Roads. After he was going to have a martini and swim across Hampton Roads, nothing to it. And I had rented this little house, and a lot of the two or three of the guys that I worked with would come there, and my partner would, he cooked. He was an old guy. He was 60 years old or so. Of course, I was in my 20s then, but it made a good partnership. He was like my father in a way, and he would cook these meals, and I'd tell these other guys, come on down, and you can pay Tom something for the meal, and it'll help him, and we'll have something to talk about. Anyway, we're sitting there talking about this guy that's going to swim across Hampton Roads, and I said, well, that's no big deal. I could do that. And they give me this heart. I said, all right, I'll do it. So we went up to the starting point where this guy was going to go. And Jimmy, one of the guys, said, give him a 5-minute start and then go. So I gave him a 5-minute start. And then I took off. And a guy was supposed to get my boat, which was anchored on the other side, and bring it around and be my escort. Well, I'm halfway across in the middle of Hampton Roads in the channels with all the big boats going by and stuff. No boat. I figured, well, I'll just keep swimming. So finally, a Coast Guard boat came by. And the only thing with the Coast Guard boat, they wanted to get in front of me. And it was a diesel engine. And all these fumes were coming back. I said, look, you guys, if you get in back of me, it'd be much nicer. I want to breathe all these fumes. But I went the rest of the way, and just about the time I touched bottom, my boat showed up.
Oh, really? Thanks for that.
And what happened? The guy had rented aground, and I didn't know that. He didn't say anything about it. Well, that was any problem. But when I went to go get my boat the next day, it was 3/4 sunk because it was a wooden boat and it loosened the wood slats on the bottom a little bit. And as it turned out, I got had it fixed, and I had insurance on it because I was still paying for it. And I got a new engine in it and got it all fixed up. So it worked out to be a good thing. What do they call it?
A blessing in disguise.
A blessing in disguise. I'm trying to say that.
And that was in the Chesapeake Bay, is that right?
Yeah.
And you did that swim two more times after that?
Yeah. Well, somebody decided that would be a great idea to make a regular swim. And so I swam it two more times. The second time, there was a bunch of guys from the Navy that were in that, and the guy that won was the one that was in charge of teaching people how to recover out of a plane, you know, when it went underwater and so forth. And he was a hell of a guy, I'll tell you. When I finally got to the beach and walked up, there he is sitting in the chair where the lifeguard was, smoking a cigar. I mean, the guy was great. I mean, you know, I never would train swimmer or anything like that. I just loved the water and you know, learned to swim myself and so forth. But he was a champion college swimmer before this all started. But then the third time, I almost didn't get in because I hadn't been practicing, hadn't been in the water, and I was the business was kind of dropping off, and I wasn't making much money and didn't have enough time to spend, you know, in the water. But I was going to get in anyway, so I got in, and I made it across there. But when I got to the beach, I laid down there. I was so tired and exhausted. I just hit that beach and laid down. Next thing I know, there's the paramedics there. They thought I'd passed out. We're going to get out of here. I'm all right. You know? So, but that was just one of those stories.
Brilliant. Now, I want to go back to the other thing as well. So you talked about riding your bike to school and, you know, picking apples off the tree on the way. Overall, when you were young, what was the diet like? I mean, as far as had they started manufacturing and processing yet?
You had good food back then.
Okay, and what about obesity rates? How did everyone look back then?
You know, when I look back, I don't remember a whole lot of fat people. I remember there was a lady down the street, and she was really fat, but that was such an unusual thing. And if you look at some of the movies from back in the 40s, like, the movies as well as the documentaries, like when all the people were greeting the soldiers coming back, and you look at the crowd, you don't see any people that are obese or anything. But we didn't have all this stuff that they put in our foods today. And of course, who knows what we're breathing either.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially when you get more congested, like Miami area and Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah. It's
at least they've cut down on the emissions from a lot of these cars. But when I was with Opelika, we not only had to put out fires and so forth, but we had to inspect cars. And these cars would come through there smoking with... And fumes were in there. Oh, I mean, it's a wonder I didn't die of suffocation or something.
Yeah.
We would, of course, we didn't have to stay there the whole time. We'd take turns. You'd go out for a couple hours, and this guy would go out for a couple hours and so forth. But it was pretty bad. And I'm glad that part was over. I mean, I didn't want anything to do with the inspecting cars. They finally stopped inspecting them. And mostly today, you don't really see any these old jalopies that are smoking and all rusted apart and so forth, except the old car that we had ourselves. And that wasn't smoking. Right? In fact, we had this 19... What year was that, Nisia?
64 or something.
64, yeah. Plymouth Valiant with a slant six engine. And... it was getting pretty damn rusty, and it looked pretty bad. And I remember when I made lieutenant, I was in the training. Whenever you make lieutenant, you have to go down and help the recruits in training. And they had brought it in a whole bunch, well, I'd say about five or six cars from the junkyard so the guys could practice using the jaws of life and that sort of thing. Well, I go to work this morning, guys come run up, money, money, money. They got a Plymouth Valiant over here. It looks better than yours. You
can switch it out.
But the engine in that thing just purred. The day that we sold it to this girl that wanted it to go to used it to go to college. And as it drove away, that engine just purred. And I just couldn't believe how that engine ran so well all those years, and the body was just falling apart. I even fiberglassed the floor so that you didn't put your foot through it.
Brilliant. Well, you talked about the coming home from the war. So from school age, what led you in? Were you drafted? Did you volunteer?
Well, I hooked school and I went down to enlist in the Navy. I thought maybe I can get in. They didn't call them SEALs then, but into the UDT thing. Well, the first test they gave me was the colorblind test, I think. Yeah. I didn't pass that. So I just waited until they drafted me. I got a letter from President Roosevelt, said that my friends and neighbors have selected me to represent them in the Armed Forces of the United States. Please report for duty.
Thanks, friends and neighbors. So you joined the Army then, you said?
Yeah.
Okay, and then how long did you train and where were you deployed to?
Well, we went to, they sent me down to Camp Fanning, Texas. And that's near Kilgore, Texas, if anybody ever heard of it. And I'm assuming that they were training me to go to the Pacific, because actually the war in Europe was over, but we were still fighting in the Pacific, and we knew that the Japs weren't going to just quit. So they were giving me all this training, mostly I would assume jungle training. And then when I was in KP one day, there was a big hullabaloo, and I find out what the hell it is. They said they dropped a bomb in Japan. It wiped out a whole city. Oh, come on. A whole city, one bomb. You know, I didn't believe. But that was the thing that probably saved me. I don't know if it saved me, because I might have survived. But if it hadn't been for that, I know I would have been fighting the Japanese in the Pacific. But anyway, because of that, they sent me over to Europe with the occupation forces. And that's where I spent my overseas time in Germany.
Beautiful. So the conflict had finished. You were there just to kind of transition the country back to normality.
Yeah.
Okay.
Basically.
And how did that look? What kind of role did you have when you were doing that?
Well, I was a photographer, and mostly just small things like Joe Blow makes sergeant. So you take a picture of this guy and sends it to his hometown newspaper, you know. And then one time we had a resort up on top of the mountain at Zugspitz, and something happened. The train derailed or something, and they were no contact with them except maybe radio, I don't know, for about a week. And so they sent me and a correspondent and a guy that did cartoons and stuff up there to see what happened. Well, we got up there, and these guys, they had a ball. I mean, everything was there at the resort, and they were drinking and shacking up with the girls and having parties, and everybody was thinking, you know, we're going to go up there and find that they didn't have enough to eat, or they were having a hard time, and they had nothing but a ball. So, but that was one of the assignments that I had. And then when they decided that dependents of firefighters, or it was officers first, would come overseas, because they never had let dependents come over. And then I was assigned to take some pictures of some of the dependents and send them back and so forth. And that job's kind of fizzled out for a while, and then they sent me to Karlsruhe, where I was working in this train station where we fed the troops as they went through. And about all I did, if they were going on furlough, like to Switzerland or someplace, then they had to pay for the meal, which was a quarter, or one mark, which was 25 cents. So I was in charge of taking care of the money. And some of them would pay in Swiss francs and some of them would pay in French francs and German marks, and how to take care of it and make sure that all the money was there and the right money was there, you know, from each country. And other than that, we just had some great meals there because we were, you know, taking care of the troops. And I remember the sergeant that was in charge, almost every day we'd have steak and eggs that he would order up. And if we ordered them, we got it too. So that worked out great. But other than that, you know, we just took care of the troops and made sure that they were fed and that they got back on the train in time and that sort of thing. And let's see, where did I go after that? They sent me down to Ingolstadt, and I was only there for a short time, and then I got my orders to come home.
Okay, and what year did you get out of the military?
47. Okay. May of 47, I think, was on my discharge. Right.
All right, well then, and that was when you did the diving and the baby photography and all that stuff after?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so then let's walk us through the fire service. I know we talked a bit before we started recording. When did you decide that you wanted to be a firefighter, and then how was your entry into the profession?
Well, as I was talking before about diving and so forth, I thought, boy, if I ever get to Florida, well, that's clear water and so forth. Well, this company that I worked for decided to send somebody down to Florida, and I was one of the ones that they wanted to send down. I thought, no matter what, I'm not going back. And so we struggled. Like I say, there weren't a lot of babies to take pictures of down here. At that time, they were mostly all retired people and so forth. And I met some of the divers that were local and became pretty good friends with them. And they were telling me, hey, we're on the fire department. And, you know, tomorrow maybe we get a little bit of rest if we don't get any calls or anything. And I'm finding out more and more about the fire department. I thought, hey, I got to get on the fire department. And then if I have a day off, I can go diving with these guys and so forth. So I started applying for the different departments, and I was either too old or I was too skinny or colorblind or something. I don't know. And I was trying every trick in the book. Like I say, I put a weight belt on. I didn't have any stomach at all. Pictures of me, like, it's caved in here. So I could put a shirt on over top of a weight belt, and you couldn't even see it. And
you're just trying to tip the scales to match their minimum weight.
And finally, Opa-locka had the oldest age limit. I think it was 35. And I just made it under the bar there, and I got on Opa-locka, and then I was on there until from 63 to 72, and the county took it over. And that was the best thing that ever happened to me.
And when you first started your career, what were your shift cycles?
I think we had one day on and one day off, didn't we?
Same as that.
No, it wasn't the same, because when they came along with the idea that you got a C date, I thought, oh man, this can't be true. And not another day off?
See, it's interesting, because now, you know, the 24/48s, you know, I don't know if you know, but Boca up the road here does 24/72s. And with the call volume that they have now, I mean, they're running 24 hours straight, a lot of these inner city departments. And they're realizing now that, you know, that even the 48, and I'm doing air quotes because, you know, people say 2 days off, it's not really, but that even that is not sufficient to recover from every single shift being awake all night.
Yeah.
So speaking of that, what did your 24 hours look like when you first started? Were you running a lot, or is it more like we hear about the quieter days?
Well, of course, when you first get on, I've been already on the other fire department on Opa-locka, but nonetheless, when I came to the county, I was new to them anyway, And what they do is wherever they have a vacancy, maybe somebody's out sick or something like that, you go here, you go to there. I went one time from Station 21, they sent me there, which is right at Baker's Holdover, all the way down to Homestead in the same day and back. But finally, it works on the system of seniority, and seniority of your rank. I mean, they have a seniority list for the firefighter and for the lieutenant captain. Well, you're familiar, probably. But finally, when I had enough seniority, I bid the station at Baker's Holdover, which is right on the water. And I thought, this is my place, you know, on the water, because water rescue is what I really wanted to be in. And so I was very happy there, although I didn't have that many water rescues because the lifeguards got most of the water rescues. But on the other side, on the bay side, once in a while, there'd be a boat that was capsized, or a car would go into the canal or something like that. And so I really didn't get that many, you know, whatever. But it was a great place to work anyhow. And we used to have, I shouldn't even say this, but we used to call it water rescue, and I'd go outside the station and dive around there and pick up some lobster and bring it in, and I kept the captain happy. I'd give him a couple lobsters, and we'd have some for ourselves. And we actually did. It was practice, you know. We would practice diving and so forth, especially me. But and another thing, at Station 21, I decided that it wasn't that far. I'd start riding my bike to work. And it was about 18 miles. So I told Nisi, I said, I'm going to ride my bike to work. And I got a 5-gallon bucket, and I got some bungee cord and put it on the back, put my uniform and everything in there. And I got up around 5 o'clock in the morning, and I had to be there by 7. And I get there just a little bit early, just enough to run in the shower and put my uniform on and ready for work. And sometimes I get there early enough, I'd go for a little run. And one of the guys that I worked with, he was slightly diabetic, and I talked him into running. And so we would have time sometimes in the morning, and we would run it. And his diabetic, I mean, he wasn't really diabetic, but he was on the verge. He said that his doctor told him that he was so much better now that he's been running and so forth. And so he was real happy with that. And then I met this other firefighter, name is Andy Sendry, and he was a complete athlete. And he heard that I was a diver, and he was a diver. And we went to Bimini together, and it was like the gunfight at the Corral.
OK Corral,
yeah. Where I'd be diving in 30 feet and going down to the bottom and looking around, and he'd go down 30 feet. And then we go out further, and we're down at 40 feet, and he's down at, then we're down at 60 feet. And he's, and we decided that both of us were about the same. But we would get together, and he'd try to figure out something that the other guy couldn't do. Well, I remember one day he put the ladder up, and instead of climbing the ladder, we got on the inside of the ladder and pulling yourself up rung by rung. And then he got me into running, because he was really into running a lot. He did a lot of 10Ks and even marathons and stuff. So
he did the Ironman in Hawaii.
Yes, he did the Ironman in Hawaii.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He's an incredible athlete. He really...
And he that's the funny part. He thinks I'm good, but I could never keep up with him. Of course, he is a little bit younger than me. But anyway, he got me into running, and pretty soon somebody suggested that we try to do a 10K. And I thought, well, you know, I'll try. If I can't make it, I'll walk or something. And it worked out pretty good. I did the 10K, and then we start looking around doing 10Ks. And then it became two or three of us at this stage. And somebody said, think we could do a marathon? And I'm thinking, a marathon, 26 miles. I don't know. And from somewhere or somebody, they gave me this book. And I don't know whatever happened to it, telling you how to train for a marathon. And it worked. I trained just according to this book, and I got in the Orange Bowl Marathon. I didn't set any records, maybe for being slow, but at least I finished it. And right at the end, I remember that we had maybe a half a mile to go, and I was really tired. I started to walk a little bit, and there was this girl there. All I know is she said her name was Karen. That's all I know about her. But she had headphones and stuff, and she was playing Rocky. Anyway, with that song and her, we just took off and we made it.
I don't know what that's all about.
No, don't. I mean, we're leading through all these different things. It's probably, you know, coming up from the surface from somewhere. So was that, I mean, your emotional now, was that a huge achievement for you in the life journey then to finish that marathon?
Oh, yeah. I never thought in my life I'd run 26 miles.
Well, especially when you couldn't even eat because half your face wasn't working when you were seven. So that's a hell of a hell of a journey from there.
It was quite an achievement. After that, it seemed like the 10Ks were so much easier. But the thing of it is, I started running again because I wore my knees out doing triathlons and running 10Ks and stuff. And so I decided to get new knee, especially the one knee. I got that done. And then a few years later, I got the other one done. And when you get your new knees, they tell you, you're not supposed to run, you're not supposed to ski, you're not supposed to jump, you're not supposed to do this. And I said to the doctor, why do you think I had my knees done? You don't want me to do anything. So I really took it easy for a while, and I didn't run, I didn't do anything. I thought, the heck with it. And especially lately when I decided to do this Spartan thing, I thought, you know, I'm 91 now. If these things last 10 years, I'll be 101. I probably won't be doing this kind of stuff anymore. I don't know. Maybe I will. But I'm going to start running on it. So I started running again, and I couldn't run at all. It seemed like I'd run a couple hundred yards, and I'd be out of breath. So I got my ankle weights that I'd had for a long time, and I put them on, and there's a little park over here, and I put the ankle weights on and ran around there. And then when I come into the Y, we run around the gym there, you know, four or five times. And I had a hard time keeping up with some of these girls in this class. It's almost all women except for about two guys. And they make me look like a wimp. It's embarrassing. But gradually I found out that, you know, I can run. In fact, the other day when I went there, I suddenly got this spurt of energy. I don't know where it came from. And I took off and I was running past everybody. Didn't last too long. And suddenly it came to an abrupt end and I was out of breath. But it came out of nowhere. And I just felt like the old self, you know, and like nothing to it. But it doesn't last like that.
Now, how long ago did you have the knees done?
Well, this last one was right before we took that cruise, wasn't it? How long ago was that?
It would have been at least 2016.
Okay, so somewhat.
Earlier.
Yeah.
Right. Because so when we met, was the Spartan race in West Palm, wasn't it? By Boca.
Yeah.
And that was a 5K, basically, but not 5K running, up and down and climbing obstacles and through water. And that really struck me because it wasn't, like you said, it wasn't listening to, let's just say, poor medical advice where, yeah, we're going to fix your knees and then that way you'll be able to sit nicely for the rest of your life. You know, you like you said, why would you get your knees done if you weren't going to move? What is your mindset been as far as aging? Because, I mean, everything I've seen that you've done this last, let's say, three decades seems to be not an ignoring aging, but just ignoring what we see now as the calibration of aging, which is, oh, well, I'm 45. No wonder my knees are shot and I'm on blood pressure medication. So what's your mindset every day as far as the aging process?
I never really thought about it unless somebody brought the subject up. And then I'd kid about it and I would say, well, you young whippersnappers. And you know, I'd put on a little bit of an act. But I never really think about it. I've always liked challenges. And somebody tell me that I can't do it, then I'm going to do it. Or I'm going to die trying. And most of my friends were like in their 40s and 50s. So I never really thought about, you know, old people, you know. They're old people, these guys. I'm not one of them. I'm one of these young guys. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of my mindset, I think. My daughter was having a party, and she invited us. And Nisha said, would it be all right if we bring some of our friends to the party? And my daughter says, yeah, that's fine. Come on. Afterwards, my daughter says, Mom, I should call it to her. She says, your friends are the same age as my friends. And it was true. I mean, most of them were pretty young. Most of the people that I dive with and stuff were much younger. And we do have some older friends, too. We have some friends that, the ones that just had lightning strike their boat, they've lived on their boat for who knows when, what, 25 years?
Really.
Yeah. But when I retired from the fire department, we had bought a trawler, and we took off. And for 16 years, we lived on it. And that was good for staying in shape, too, because in the Bahamas, I just get up in the morning, run to the back of the boat, and jump in, swim around this little island, and then come back and do some push-ups and pull-ups on the back of the boat. And we had some buckets always on a boat, and we fill them with water and then do curls with the bucket of water. And before you even have your coffee, and I mean, then you're ready to go. You jump in the dinghy and you go out and you're diving all day, shooting fish and picking up lobster and conch and that sort of thing. I mean, the kind of vacation that people would pay $1 million for. We were living it up. I go back to the fire station and these guys would say, oh, money. You're living the life. I'd love to do that, but my wife, she wouldn't leave the shopping malls. Or my wife gets seasick. She can't stand boats and so forth. And they're so depressed over the fact that I'm having all this fun. Not depressed, but they're jealous of what they'd like to do too. Yeah. And it really was a great life. I didn't want to stop, but she's had fibromyalgia, and she had a problem with her hip, finally got her hip replaced. And she just couldn't, handle the boat that much anymore. She was the one that drove the boat most of the time, where it looked like it. We'd have it on autopilot, but we'd have to sit there, you know, and she'd be sitting there like she's driving away. Well, she's better at getting the red and green buoys in the right side, whereas I have a little trouble.
at least they had a different design. I mean, one of them was a triangle and the other was sort of a different shape.
Right.
But as far as the colors, some of them would just be a stick, you know, with a different color on it. And she's very good at that, not being colorblind.
Well, it's interesting as well you say about the boat, because you know, most people's aspirations that live in normal suburban life is to once, you know, maybe the anniversary or a special birthday, they'll go and get lobster, you know, and there you were jumping off the back of a boat, you know, eating this amazing food, and you know, therefore it was paying off, you know, like you said, you're exercising and
fresh air.
So, yeah, exactly. And we've kind of walled ourselves into ill health a lot of times. And then, like we said before, then you add in the poisoning of our food and, you know, the abuse of the meat that we end up eating. And the answer is so blatantly simple. It's just going back to, you know, what your parents did, what they ate and how they farmed. I think that would solve a huge amount of the issues that we see.
Well, our friends from Australia used to come over and spend a couple months in the Bahamas with us. And it was like going back to nature. I think he liked to hunt and stuff anyway, but we were living off the land, only we were living off the sea. We'd get up in the morning and after the swim and exercise stuff, when we go out and we dive all day and we bring back some fish and stuff. And we would have that for dinner. But meantime, we'd sit up on the bow of the boat, and a lot of times she would make this lobster dip and a cold beer and lobster dip after time. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that.
Now, with the transition from the fire service, you were actually, was it 68 when you retired?
Yeah, I was the oldest guy on the fire department.
Okay, so before we even talk about retirement, so again, what kept you there so long? What kept you able to function well as a firefighter at that age?
Well, I just did the same thing I always did. And I rode my bike to work every day. And we could get exercise. You know, right there at Baker's Hallover, where we had that station, we would get off, and Andy Sendry and I would go to the beach. And there was a Vita course there. And, you know, I guess you're familiar with them. You know, you do the first couple of exercises, which are just sort of warm up and stretching and stuff. And then you get into push ups and pull ups and that sort of thing. And then we go for a swim. And then I jump on my bike and go home. And he'd jump on his bike and go home. And then I had a little fiberglass shop. And I'd go over there and I'd be hand sanding and lifted, because it was just me by myself and I had to do everything. And so I, you know, basically stayed in pretty good shape. And so I just kept doing the same things that I always did. She's got people coming to cut the lawn and stuff. I said, what's the matter? I can cut the lawn for you if you want. I mean, I'm not helpless anymore just because I'm 90.
Well, speaking of that, so you were 68 when you left. One of the things that I talk about a lot here is the sleep deprivation and, you know, us being up all night. Did you notice a big difference, like, the following year, say, after you retired, when you actually got to be in your own bed every night?
Not really, because as soon as I retired, we jumped on that boat and we would be over in the Bahamas or someplace. And when you're on that boat all day, or you're swimming all day, or diving all day, at 8 o'clock you can't keep your eyes open anymore. So I slept pretty good, and although we had an air conditioner on there, if we had the hatch open, there was usually a nice breeze, and we'd actually have to have a sheet over top of us, mm-hmm. You know, not a blanket or anything, but I mean, it was just like a perfect temperature.
Right, but I mean, as far as your sense of well-being, you were sleeping well now versus one eye open with the tones about to go off. Did you find that your health improved even more after you got to get away from the alarms in the station?
I'd say, well, I got more exercise because, you know, I could exercise all day. You don't
realize you're exercising because you're having fun. That's what I've said about people. They say, how do you stay in shape? Because I've been diving my whole life and I didn't realize I was exercising. I thought I was having fun. And it's true. If you're doing something that you like, Andy, he loves to run. And for no other reason, he can find an excuse to go running. And he got me into it. And I wasn't quite like him. I mean, but I did get to the point where I enjoyed going for a run, but I didn't go out of my way to do it. I'd get up in the morning and run down to maybe Hollywood Boulevard and back, and it would just get all the blood circulating and everything, and you really feel like you're ready to go for the day.
Now, what about, we're going back to the fire service for a moment, what was the fitness standards, like where was the bar held? Because I know we've had that Hialeah, we talked about my first apartment, they set the bar so high, they beat the hell out of us when we were in the orientation there. But then there's other departments now where they fight very hard against their administration, sometimes even their own union, for even an annual physical test. You know, people say it's unfair.
Guys don't want to take a physical because they'll find something wrong. Right?
Yeah, so. Well, not even just the medical, but the physical, like it's unfair to ask me to have to drag a hose and climb five floors, you know, and it's ridiculous. So,
but it's a challenge.
Exactly. Yes, and that's the thing I can see with you. It's pride, you know, and it's like you said, it's the competitive nature, which I think it should be in all of us. But in your career at Metro Dade and the department before, did they nurture that fitness? Were most people in pretty great shape?
Well, right now, they have a pretty good fitness program. I'd like to go down there and see what it's like because it's a friend of mine that's running it. But when I got on in Opa-locka, like I say. It was just a little department. And about all it consisted of was running like 100 yards in less than 20 minutes. I remember the day that I ran and I didn't have any running shoes. And one of the guys that was there, he ran first. I said, can I borrow your shoes, the running shoes, the same size? And I used his shoes to run. And then they took us over to the pool and they wanted us to do, I remember doing sit-ups and you were supposed to do like 20 sit-ups or something. And I said, do I get extra points if I do more? I said, I'll do another 20 or 30 if you want, you know. No, that's enough. That's enough. And this morning, it was ice cold. One of those days when the temperature goes down, it must have been 40 degrees. And I didn't really want to go in that water. The thought of, I mean, I love the water, but not when it's ice cold. But I had to swim in the water. And because there was, I think, 15 or 20 people that came that day to try out, and I'd say that at least 12 of them left when they found out that they had to go in that water. And I felt like leaving, but I thought, I need this job. And I jumped in there and did the swim, and which was nothing. I mean, if it had been warm water, I would have been playing. But I had to swim underwater, which that was the easiest part, and just swim up and down a couple times. And that's about all there was to it, you know, because it was a small department. They didn't have any real training program. They didn't have a tower to climb up and pull hose or anything of that sort. And they taught me how to drive the fire truck. You know, there was some warehouses right there near the fire station, and we'd take the fire truck over there and practice backing up and going forward and so forth. And there'd be three guys on a shift. There was two fire trucks and a rescue. We had a call. We each got in a different vehicle and went out. And this is after doing inspections. Doing the auto inspections. We put all the money and stuff away real fast, jump in the trucks and go to wherever the call was, put the fire out or treat the victim, whatever, and then come back and inspect cars again.
One of the reasons why I reached out to Dominic Barbera is he was one of the first medics that we had. So what was that like for you guys going from primarily fire to transitioning to the EMS stuff as well?
Well, all we had in Opa-locka was first aid. And we would, anything that we couldn't do, we called rescue. I mean, we called the ambulance, and the ambulance would come and so forth. You know, we had first aid equipment. I mean, somebody had a big cut or something. We bandaged it up and that sort of thing. But the EMT and the paramedic thing, they never got into that until I got onto the Dade County Fire Department. And then when I was on that department, on the Dade County, they told me and several other guys, you guys are going to go into training. You're going to do the EMT-2. That was called EMT-1 and EMT-2, which now is called paramedic. And this friend of mine, Bill Maloney, who passed away since then, we were studying the charts on different heart rhythms, you know, and that sort of thing. But about the time that I got through with the course, I got a chance to bid a station because I had enough seniority by then. And then I bid the station and I was on an engine. So I never used anything but the EMT stuff. No, I never got into the paramedics. And I was really a little afraid of it anyway because I went on a call. Even this was in Opa-locka. And when I pulled up on the scene, oh my God, look at all that blood and stuff. Turned out it was green paint. And I thought, boy, if I ever got, if they ever knew what it...
Brilliant. Yeah, because that's, like I said, that's what brought me to Dominic Barbera, who came on the show and sadly passed away recently. But yeah, I mean, to see that, I mean, obviously he went very strongly into the paramedic side. I think he worked rescue his whole career, didn't he, I believe, or at least for a large part. Yeah, it's crazy when I hear my generation, I've been on 15 years and even younger, kind of beating their chests and saying, oh, I just want to do the fire stuff. And it's like, well, you entered a fire service where EMS is integrated. And I always give the example that you pull someone out of a fire and you lay them on the front lawn. Now what? If you've got no medical training, then you're kind of useless. So it's exciting now to see where it is. But it must have been very interesting being anywhere that was purely fire and then having the EMS stuff, you know, slowly filter in.
Well, I know that if I was a victim, I would rather have a paramedic attended to me than a doctor. Because most of these doctors want to sit in their office and prescribe pills or something of that sort. And when it comes to emergency, they're not equipped for emergencies. They don't even know. I mean, there are emergency doctors, the guys that are at the hospital in the emergency room. I mean, they're really good. But these guys that are paramedics, I mean, they get so much training that in case of emergency, they're just as well, just as good, and I think better than the average doctor would be. Don't you think so?
I do. I had an example of that. And I'm about, it's funny, this afternoon I'm going to interview a pediatric emergency physician who is amazing. He actually is the medical director for Coral Springs and the Parkland area fire departments. And I've had other ones that are in a similar position. And like you said, I would want them working on my family any day of the week. But the other people under the doctor umbrella, I was on a plane and a gentleman collapsed and they kind of did the hierarchy announcement. Is there a doctor on the plane? Is there a nurse? And they finally got down to paramedic. It was several job descriptions later. And so I came along and, you know, there's like three or four people hunched around this person telling each other how important they were. One guy taking a blood pressure, not even using the stethoscope, just using the cuff and holding the wrist. And then they all kind of went away. And I said to the stewardess, I'm like, would you mind if I assess this guy from the beginning. And I mean, I ended up sitting with him the rest of the flight, but it was just observing. They had no sense, I don't mean that in a mean way, but they had no experience assessing an emergency. So they may be amazing chiropodists or, you know, whatever their speciality was. But yeah, when it comes to emergency medicine, the EMTs and the medics and then the ER physicians and nurses are a completely different breed than the rest of the medical community.
I remember one day at the fire station, I got something caught in my throat and I start coughing and sort of choking. And I thought, damn, I better run outside. These guys are going to grab me. And I didn't want them to practice on me.
Start Heimlicking the hell out of me. All right. Well, I know we've been going almost an hour and a half, and I want to be mindful of your time. So I want to transition to a couple of closing questions that I like to ask everyone. But before I do that, I got one extra question for you. You did the Spartan race, you know, with me. We were lucky enough to run side by side, and I'm so glad because we got to meet with the Operation Enduring Warrior and the GIVE team and all those other great organizations that were running. You have done skydiving recently, is that right? Or you're
That's
about to do one with Jonathan?
My daughter said, I did a tandem jump. I just thought it would be nice to do something special, like for my birthday. It turned out that I didn't do it on my birthday.
73rd, okay.
It looked like it would be fun. So I went, and of course, it's not the same as being a skydiver, or, you know, jumping out on your own and so forth. I went with a guy, and he didn't look like he was suicidal. And, and we had a good time. I forgot. In fact, I don't know if I would have made it if it was on my own, because I forgot to pull a ripcord. He was going like this, but the guy was taking a picture there, another sky. And I was having so much fun, and I'm smiling, and my cheeks are flapping up and down. I mean, it's hilarious when you see the movie, and my cheeks are going. But he finally pulled the ripcord himself, and everything was all right. But he probably has the same problem with other people that he takes up. It's, to him, I was thinking, it's similar to when I took people out diving and they're having a good time or something, but they forget about certain things that they've got to do or shouldn't do, and you just have to watch them.
Reel them in.
And he was kind of watching me, looking out for me.
Especially as he was attached to you.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing. I did a skydive in New Zealand, actually, in Te Pau, I think.
Where?
Te Pau. I think it was Taupau, T-A-U-P-A-U.
Oh, Taupau.
Oh, Taupau. Yes. You didn't understand because I said it completely wrong.
Lake Taupau,
that's right. Yes. Beautiful. And I'm not going to lie, I consider myself somewhat brave. I was terrified before that. And finally got up there. I'll never forget, because when we were in a tandem, they're sitting on the plane about to jump out. You're not even touching the plane anymore. You're just strapped to them like a baby in a harness. Mm-hmm. That is the most bizarre feeling. But when I hit the ground, I was literally ready to sign up to become an instructor. That fear of the unknown was what I was scared of, and the experience was so much fun. So,
yeah, it was. It was, to me, it was similar to diving, because with that amount of airflow, it was like being in the water. I could do the same thing in the air that I could do in the water, whereas normally that wouldn't make any difference. But with that pressure, you know, and I was getting a really big kick out of it. It was so much fun. But you almost forget about the fact that you're falling. And
the ground's coming.
Yeah.
So because Jonathan Lopez was talking about trying to get you up there again.
Yeah, I know.
Is that something that you're thinking of doing? I don't have to commit on the microphone right now, but
I don't know. At my age, I don't. That's one thing about being old. You don't have too much to lose. So, my grandmother, I remember first time she got on an airplane. She was 80 years old. And this was her first flight, and somebody asked her, "Aren't you afraid? A little afraid going on an airplane?" She says, "I'm 80 years old now, so I don't have anything to worry about."
It's a good way of looking at it. But like we talked about, though, with the whole calibration thing, My grandmother's about to turn 102. My granddad actually got cancer at 99. And the bizarre thing was, the doctor said physiologically he was so young that it spread through him like a younger person. So I think normally in the elderly, it doesn't spread very fast. So I think without the cancer, he'd probably made it several more years. But it's so funny because you talk about the younger friends. They lived in this you know, little English street. And we'd ask them, you know, is it nice? And they go, yeah, it's okay, but it's just full of old people. And these quote unquote old people would be like 20 years younger than they were. But again, it's that mindset. Well,
that's what a lot of people, when they move like to assisted living or something like that, that's the first thing they say is, oh, it's nothing but a bunch of old people there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, then speaking of that, and so skydiving or not, is there anything on your list, because you just finished the Spartan race the other day, that you want to do next?
Well, it seemed like about the only thing left is base jumping. That's a little scary looking to me.
I don't think you can get distracted when you're base jumping. So
I
wouldn't bring the cameraman with you on that one.
No, I don't think I'd even got a cameraman to go. I don't know if I'd ever get to that or not. Maybe I can figure something else. Yeah. But it's just that when you reach like a certain milestone in your life, it requires doing something a little bit different, I think. You know, like maybe when you're turning 50 the first time, you ride a motorcycle or something of that sort. In fact, that happened to my mother when she was 80. Who was it? It took her for a motorcycle ride, and she enjoyed it. My mother was, she was quite easy to, she would like challenges herself. I mean, she didn't talk about it much or anything, but if there was a challenge that she could do, she probably would do it.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, well, I think that's the thing, is like I was saying with my fear of skydiving, which I was, what was I, like 27 when I finally did. But what a horrible feeling to have never done something because you were scared, and then finally try it when you were 60, 70, 80, and then realize that you love it and you could have been doing it for decades.
Well, it'd been quite expensive to be doing it for decades.
Yeah, that's true. Now, one more thing before we go to the closing question. I meant to ask you way back when we were talking about coming back from the war, and this is purely a selfish question for me, education-wise, but a big core of this podcast is, you know, spreading the compassion and kindness and people's powerful stories and solutions to some of the problems, whether it's food or medicine. But one thing that baffles me, and I haven't really had many people that could answer this because they, you know, weren't there then, is how we went from, as a nation, and this is England too, so not just picking on America, a war where we were fighting predominantly to protect a different religion, you know, a lot of the Jewish people, we're fighting alongside all these different nationalities, how we found ourselves in certain areas in the 50s with so much prejudice and racism. Did you witnessing that with your own eyes see how that came about, or was it just the minority got so much, you know?
Well, growing up, I was very aware of it, but in the Army, we had a couple black guys that were just another guy, like on the fire department. I mean, Joe Blow and this guy and that guy. We're all in this together. They're no different than me, except maybe he's a little darker than I am, or I'm a little whiter than he is, or so forth. But I remember at the PRO, which was the public relations office that we worked in, where I was a photographer, and the couple correspondents there. And they were just sitting around talking one day. And one of them said, you know, it's a funny thing. He says, you know, like all, and these guys been all through the war, and not like me, I just got over. He said, you know, the Italians and the Irish and the Jewish and all, we're all in, all buddies over here fighting together and saving each other. And what about the black people? But I was taught as a child, though, you know, to treat everybody the same. But I could see that it wasn't done. You know, it wasn't that way. And, you know, you got to remember, I'm from the 20s and 30s when they used to have signs, black here, whites here. And when I went to Norfolk, I mean, that was back in the 50s and 60s after the war. They would still try to make the blacks go to the back of the bus and whites in the front and so forth. And, of course, that's when it all really, as you say, shit hit the fan, because President Kennedy started the whole thing with as far as segregation and in the schools and everything else. And there was, well, in Alabama and Mississippi and those places where people were actually being murdered, you know, and just for standing up for what they believed in. And it was a pretty terrible time.
Yeah, well, but that's what I have so much, you know, so many problems understanding is, like you said, you stand side by side with people of all colors and creeds, and you fight what truly at that time was evil. I mean, you know, no one can argue that. And then you come back to America, England, and then you're lynching people. And we had the same. We had the, what was it called? The Wind, I forget the name now. But there was this famous ship that first brought people from, I think it was the islands, Jamaica, I think, to England. And that was a big opposition to that. And I don't understand how you can go through hell side by side with these people, and the same with the fire service, especially when we're wearing our gear. You can't tell what sex, color, creed we are. Yeah. But then be so inherently racist to the point where you would kill, just years after these people have, you know, protected your country and you fought alongside them. And maybe it's not the people that were ever fighting alongside that actually did that, but to the next worst thing is to stand by and let it happen. So that, yeah, I just, as a younger person who's, like, my granddad was in World War II, I'm trying to figure out how we got to that point.
Yeah, but I think really, though, it helped in a way, because I know a lot of Italians and Irish after the war, you go see your buddy and he's Italian, but your sister likes this guy. And you know, they get married and I think, except for the blacks, it seemed like there was always this prejudice against blacks. But as far as like the Italians and the Irish and the Germans, I don't think there's as much prejudice, if you want to call it that, with them after the war as there was before the war. But as far as the blacks, I mean, even during the war, there was a lot of prejudice with the blacks and so forth. And this one group, what's it, the Tuscanini Air Force?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
They're just now getting credit for what they did during the war. And isn't that right? And yet, the general, what's his name? He's...
Colin Powell.
Yeah, he's a black man, and here he's a general. There's got to have been a change of some sort. But some people just never change. Yeah. And... you just have to put up with them until they die.
Well, and that's the thing, when you breed them out, so you raise your children, right, the next generation, to understand that. My little boy actually was asking about it the other day. He asked me, was there historically as much racism towards Spanish people? I mean, that's a very interesting point. Yeah. But I think because California, yeah, Florida, a lot of the southern states, we neighbored with them. I don't think it was as bad. Yes, you know, there is to this day. But I told him, like, you know, Irish were thing, which again is ridiculous because I'm English, which means English, Irish, Scottish, Welsh. I mean, we're two little tiny rocks in the middle of the ocean. None of us are pure Irish or pure Scottish. So even that is insanity to come over here and then be prejudiced against people that are from the exact same place as you.
Yeah.
So there's yeah, it's insanity. But I really appreciate
your perspective.
And sometimes
it's the reverse too. That certain groups are prejudiced against us.
Oh yeah, exactly. Prejudice is a horrendous philosophy that can be taken by anyone, no matter what you look like.
The best thing is just judge a person by what he is.
Yes, by their actions. Absolutely. All right, well, thank you so much for that perspective. All right, so the first closing question I love to ask, and I'm very intrigued to hear your input.
I'm afraid of this one.
Yeah, they're pretty simple. It shouldn't be too scary. Is there a book that you love to recommend? It can be about what we've talked about, or it can be something completely different. It can be fiction, anything.
Well, actually, I don't do a whole lot of reading, but I read a book one time, and it was called How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Is it Dale Carnegie?
And I remember that book so well. When I was knocking on doors, and somebody would come to the door nasty and really, you know, insulting, I'd say, "Oh, and sir, you just want a new book called How to Win Friends and Influence People. You'll get it in the next mail." I just had to.
Yeah, you can definitely say no thank you to a cold call without being an a-hole.
You can hit people being nice just as well as you can being nasty.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's the way women do it.
What they call that, oh my goodness. What's that term where you're seeming like you're being nice, but you're actually not? Something hostility.
Yeah.
Anyway, I forget. All right, the next question. Is there a movie that you love?
You mean beside Tarzan?
We'll add Tarzan. There you go.
I'm just joking.
Brilliant. And what about a documentary? You mentioned that earlier. Is there a documentary that you love?
There's something I can't think. Actually, we watch more things on the Animal Channel and National Geographic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because I love animals and stuff like that. You know, fascinating. Right offhand, I can't think of a documentary that I would really, that I can remember right offhand anyway.
Okay, well, no, but that's good. It's funny, my sister actually works for the BBC and does a lot of the editing, the Richard Attenborough, Planet Earth, all that kind of ones. Yeah. Yeah, she's worked with him, so brilliant. All right, so then the next question, this would be an interesting one. Is there a person that you would recommend to do an interview like this to talk to the first responders and military of the world as a guest?
Estimation of people that I admire would be some of the people at the YMCA that they may not be out doing Spartan things and stuff like that, but they're incredible athletes and they do some of the things that I wish I could do. I go to this gymnastics class, Anicia, she'll tell Pepe, "Oh, he goes to the gymnastics class." Well, they think that I do gymnastics. I go to the gymnastics class and I try to imitate what they're doing, and I'm probably the class clown, because if they took a movie, they could say, "Now this is the right way, and here's Monty. We'll show you the wrong way."
That's because I was going to ask you about it. So there's a picture of you in a gymnastics area doing a handstand against a wall. So that's the class?
Yeah.
Okay. Because, I mean,
where'd you get that picture?
Your daughter sent a bunch to the Spartan people. And so she forwarded me that. So yeah, I got you holding a gun. I got you in front of the fire engine. I got a whole Monty album.
That was basic training. We were just
we just took some pictures and stuff there, and people.
Well, I'm glad though. I'm glad you didn't get to fire it. You know, I mean, that's yeah, the thing. I'm glad that you know, it ended the way it did. And I always say that about that war is, whatever we think about some of the ones that have happened since, my dad tried to force me, not force me, that's the wrong word, but try to encourage me to become a PTI, physical training instructor, in the British military. But the Falklands War just happened. And from what I can tell, it seems like maybe diplomacy would have fixed that as well. I don't know. I wasn't there, but I definitely saw how a government agency can literally cause a bloodshed of a huge amount of people. But that being said, World War II, I would have been first to sign up, because there was no question that was truly,
well, that was the feeling everywhere.
Lives. Yeah,
nobody, I wouldn't know if there was anybody that was against the war here. I understand that there were some people, but everywhere that I was, you know, as a kid and so forth, all I could see was people that were, that wanted to join up the service. My neighborhood where I worked, or where I lived, I should say, as a teenager, there was like about five different guys, and we used to hang out together and so forth. And every one of them joined up. And one was in the Marines, one was in the Navy, one was in the Army and so forth. Every one of us. And we all wanted to go. We wanted to get in there and get rid of these Japs and the Germans and so forth for all these atrocities and so forth that they've committed. I mean, we knew about the Death March, you know, in the Philippines, and we knew about the camps and with all the Jewish people, and you just, you know, it was unbelievable these things could happen, this murder on a scale like that. I remember one of the guys at the fire station one day was saying, why don't we stop trying to be the policemen of the world and stuff? And said something about, what do we care about those Germans? And anyway, I was telling him about some of the things that the Germans did, you know, that he didn't know anything about. You know, the other day at the store, and I said, you got a veteran's discount? And she said, I don't know whether I did or not. But she asked, well, what war were you? Oh, the Second World War. When was that? Was that when we were fighting with, I don't know who it was, but she had no idea.
Yeah, and that's the problem. If you can't learn from history, you know, well, it's going to repeat itself if you don't teach it.
Get that in school? I mean, no. We learned about World War I when we went to school.
But then we have a Disney-fied version of our history sometimes too. Like, we're not taught here what we did when we first settled. I say we, my people, you know, the British and the Spanish and the Portuguese and everyone else that came around the world and you know, invaded people's countries. But yeah, we need to teach them about the smallpox blankets and the genocide that we did. And, you know,
absolutely.
So, I mean, the British were the first, I believe, to do concentration camps in the Boer War. We invented them, you know, so we need to teach that. And I have to give it to, when I was younger, they were pretty open, same as the BBC is today. They just tell it as it is, you know.
Yeah, well, that's what I like about the BBC.
Yeah, but that's the way we need to do it. I mean, we have to learn from what we did.
The news is supposed to be, it's not supposed to be prejudiced. And of course, not supposed to be fake news either.
Well, I tell people all the time, I said this on the podcast before, to me, a news is a person, a man or a woman, dressed nicely, that says, here's what happened today, the end.
Yeah.
And here, exactly. It's a divided TV screen into four quadrants with four people that aren't even actually that intelligent arguing with each other about something. Meanwhile, the actual real news is completely lost in the conversation. So it's not news. It's a angry debate from people who were either all the way left or all the way right, depending on what you're watching.
Yeah, it's terrible. Well, at least like during the war, everybody was on the same page for at least 90% or more. And there wasn't this bickering or anything. And President Roosevelt was, when anything he did was good. They didn't want to get into this war, but at the same time, if it hadn't been for Roosevelt, we'd probably be going around saying Heil Hitler or something. Exactly. And they would have gotten the atomic bomb, and we were sending stuff over there so fast they couldn't sink all the ships.
Yeah, and it's just like you were saying, these horrible things happen. And even in our profession, in the fire service, when firefighters die, when they're killed in the collapse or whatever it is, if we don't learn from that, we're not honoring the dead. All the people that died in the First World War, in Vietnam, whatever it was, if we don't learn either better tactics within the military or better diplomacy to not even get into a conflict, then we're dishonoring the ones that bled, you know, for our country. So to not tell those stories in the schools and to not tell them properly on the news as well is a disgrace, I think. Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's a great place to wrap up. I just want to say thank you so much. It's an honor to have met you at the Spartan Race, but more importantly, to sit down with you and talk to, you know, someone from another generation in the profession that I adore and I'm trying to help. But to invite me to your home and pour your heart out for an hour and a half, I really, really appreciate that.
Well, it was my pleasure, and thank you very much.